Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I talk to director Neil Jordan about his new novel and also all those amazing movies from Michael Collins to The Crying Game and everything else in between. Mark Ryle has a bumper crop of new releases, plus the hothouse flower himself, Fiacna O'Brien, on chats to me about his favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app, or anywhere you choose to get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing well. An early happy St. Patrick's Day to you. And I hope you drown the shamrock or tend to the shamrock or gild the shamrock or, you know, do something with the shamrock in this strangest of years where really none of us will be doing very much of anything. But let's stick with it because hope is on the horizon. Now, in movie news, I was delighted to see all the nominations for Irish Folk at the BAFTAs, Barry Keoghan, the Wolfwalker guys. But I was particularly pleased for Niamh Alagher for her role in Calm with Horses, which is a great movie. Niamh is a brilliant actress. She really is. She just has a earthy, organic, natural quality to her. She is a serious actress and a leading light. So I'm delighted that her star is in the ascendancy because it deserves to be. And everything I've seen her in, from The Virtues to Raised by Wolves to Calm with Horses, she is just brilliant. And Calm with Horses is on Netflix. So watch it and see what all the fuss is about. Now, a lot of people were in touch last week, particularly about Mark Ryle's blistering review of Coming to America 2, or Coming to America, which is what it's called with the number 2. He hated it. He gave it 0 stars. One of the best phrases was about filling a child's nappy. Listen back to it on the podcast, because it was worth it. That's what everyone was in touch about last week. Now, in TV, I was watching this.
The only way to keep a secret between two people is to kill one of them. It's kind of true.
The state of Utah that has long been the home of the Mormons.
I love the gospel with all my heart.
They are driven by history, and they want to preserve documents.
Mark Hoffman found document after document.
First editions, history, Americana, worth $1.5 million.
He was a rock star.
Religion sometimes breeds amongst people some extremes.
The first explosion ripped through a downtown office building, killing one man. The second explosion outside of a Holiday home claimed another life.
Panic began to ensue because 2 bombs suggest a serial killer.
Then the shock came.
Yes, now that's a clip from Murder Among the Mormons, and this is on Netflix. It's been there for a week or two, and it's 3 parts, and it's all about the Mormon church in Utah, Salt Lake City, the Church of the Latter-day Saints, and in particular about 2 bombs that went off and a couple of people that were killed as a result of those bombs, and the intrigue that led up to them, all about old historical antiquarian documents pertaining to the foundation of the Mormon church. Now, that sounds a bit dry, maybe, you know, but it's not. It's kind of chilling and intriguing about the various things that were going on and possible forgeries relating to kind of the founding documents around Mormonism. And it's peopled with these very interesting characters, some of which you heard there. And it really rattles along. And the thing is, right, and documentary makers of the future, listen to this bit. Even if you're not wild about it, but I think you will be, it's 3 episodes long. That's hallelujah, because as much as I enjoy all these documentaries we're treated to, and many of which we feature on this show, some of them are far too long, as you well know. The Vow in particular was disgracefully long from before Christmas. This is 3. So even if you don't like it, it's only 3 episodes, all of which are under an hour, but you will like it It's really good. Murder Among the Mormons, now streaming on Netflix. Then one that's been out for a wee while that I didn't get around to last week was the new Raya and the Last Dragon on Disney Plus, which you have to pay $21.99 for. It's Premier Access, as they call it, or Premium Access. I think it's Premier Access. $21.99. That's a lot of money. Is it worth it? Well, if, like me, you have children and you've been in lockdown a while, as we all have been, or most of us have been, you have probably watched a lot of kids' movies to keep them entertained, and you might be looking for something new and different. And I think this might fit the bill. I mean, if you were to take them to the cinema, you would pay easily £22. This is set in Southeast Asia, and it's based on stories coming out of there. And a bit has been made about the fact that it's very Asian movie and things like that. But I that's of no consequence. And I mean that in the positive sense of the phrase, because it's a rollicking story. It's all about Raya. She's this princess and she wants to find the last surviving dragon. It's this weird kind of world where the world was all together in different parts of a dragon. And she goes on this journey to collect the different pieces of this dragon that used to exist. And there's all these different types of people in this dragon world. Now, that sounds a bit convoluted. It isn't, though. As I say, it really rocks along. It's all the leads, or most of the leads, are all young girls in it, which is great. It's a very, you know, women a superhero kind of vibe to it. But it's a great kids movie in that the action kind of never stops, even though there's a few lessons about dignity and staying true to yourself and all that, like a lot of good kids movies have. It's a really good tale that kind of has superhero-ness to it that I think your kids will really like. My 5-year-old watched it and really enjoyed it. And here's the acid test. They didn't talk. I'm not celebrating that fact, but they tend to chat a lot when they're watching stuff. They want me to know their views on, you know, most things that they're watching, but they were dead quiet. That's a good litmus test, I think. So Raya and the Last Dragon, pricey, but I think it might be worth the £22 on Disney Plus. Let me know if you might have watched it. It's been out a few weeks. John_Fardy on Twitter, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, Neil Jordan is one of Ireland's best-known film directors, having directed everything from seminal Irish movies like Michael Collins to The Crying Game. In tandem with that, he has a whole other working life as a writer of fiction, with his first set of short stories, One Night in Tunisia, dating back to the 70s, and other titles include The Sunrise with Sea Monster and, of course, Shade. His latest novel is The Ballad of Lord Edward and Citizen Small. It's a ripping read all about the little-known relationship between Lord Edward Fitzgerald, the Irish revolutionary, and the escaped slave Tony Small, who rescued him from the battlefields of the American War of Independence. The novel contains huge drama with Fitzgerald and Small traversing the globe and, of course, landing in Dublin at various times, and also in plenty of time for what would be the 1798 rebellion. I'm delighted to say I'm joined now by Neil Jordan. Hi, Neil. How are you?
Hi, how are you, John? I'm good.
I was relieved in a certain sense when I read the book, and I'll tell you why. And I've read the whole of it at this stage because I was offered an interview with Neil Jordan, and of course I said yes. And then I heard it was a novel about historical fiction and Lord Fitzgerald, and I thought, okay, well, I'll see what that's like. And it's a ripping yarn, as I said in the intro. And my feeling with sometimes historical fiction is, you know, the weight of research weighs a bit too heavy on it, you know, and people can get a bit lost in it. But this just barrels along. And I'm wondering, were you very conscious of that, that you didn't want to get lost in kind of all the research of 18th century Bahamas and Dublin and that kind of thing?
Not really, no. I mean, have you ever read The Man of the Iron Mask, or have you ever read?
Oh, yeah,
The material just told itself, really, in the end, you know? I mean, it's when you choose to tell the life of Lord Edward Fitzgerald, or a certain period of his life, you know, from the age of about 17 to his death, you know, from the perspective of somebody who knows nothing about this man and nothing about Irish history and nothing about all this sacred Irish territory, you know, I mean, that perspective in itself simplifies the story in a way. Do you understand me? Because we know as little as Tony Small did. And the all of the complications of the 1798 rebellion, of the United Irishmen, of the of their engagement with the French Revolution, of the power structure in Ireland at the time, you know, Grattan's Parliament and the British kind of empire here and the place of it here. It all becomes simplified from the perspective of somebody who has no expectations and knows nothing about these realities, you know. So that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, really, because the perspective was so unique and it was such a unique opportunity, you know, to tell this really individual story.
And is there much about Tony Small, this freed slave? Was there a lot of, or was it, I guess it was good for you that you didn't know a huge amount of it?
Well, I mean, there's almost nothing really. I mean, the only thing you can find out about this man is from the Fitzgerald letters, really, you know, and from the various biographies. And the biographies basically take their information about them, about Tony and his relationship with Lord Edward, from the letters themselves, you know.
Yeah.
And the only direct evidence I could find of him was a letter in the National Library, which is a begging letter to the family after Lord Edward had died. You know, he was in London in a place called Eyre Street in Soho, living there with a family and several young children and in a state of extreme poverty and illness. And he wrote this really plaintive begging letter to Fitzgerald's stepfather. And, you know, that's the only direct evidence that I came across about the man, you know. And so it was, I mean, I wasn't telling his story. I was telling his version of Lord Edward's story. So that simplified things in turn, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, not to give any spoilers, but Lord Fitzgerald is, you know, it's fair to say, pretty benign presence in Tony's life. They stayed friends all their lives, it seems. Was that the case? He was very good to him, put simply.
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. His life was saved by this man.
Yeah.
I mean, if this man hadn't come across him in a forest and after the Battle of Eutaw Springs in Carolina, he would have been dead, you know? Mm. Or he would have ended up as kind of a very heavily wounded prisoner in the Patriot, you know, by the American forces. But so his life was saved by this gentleman who then, there was an exchange of favors between them, really, because Lord Edward managed to get a letter of freedom from the English king, you know, from the English crown, which was a common factor in those times. And, you know, Tony Small then traveled to Ireland with him as his manservant, as his kind of his valet in a strange way, you know. So the relationship with them, between them, was both, you know, was master and servant, was friend, was savior, and, you know, kind of saved. So it went through, I would imagine, and in the novel it goes through various kind of, they follow different arcs, let's
sure.
put it that way. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. peaks and valleys. And, you know, the way you paint Tony, I know it's not about him, it's his sense of Lord Fitzgerald, but the way he views Dublin was great. For me as a dub, to see you imagining how Tony would have found, you know, 1790 Dublin, walking down the quays, and then his love of theatre, which was a great touch to it, I thought. It must have been fun for you as an Irish person to dream that up, kind of.
It was amazing, actually. Particularly you're from Dublin, you know.
Yeah.
I spent most of my life in Dublin, you know.
Yeah.
I was born in Sligo, but I grew up in basically in the remnants of this 18th century city, you know.
Yeah.
And what was left of it after various developers had their way with it, you know. But it was kind of thrilling to imagine what it would have been like, you know. I mean, we're talking about a period where the Bank of the Parliament building, the Bank of Ireland building now, you know, would still have been under construction. We're talking about a period where the vast bulk of the city would have been on the north side of the Liffey River, you know, where Capel Street Bridge was called the Essex Bridge, where the, you know, the Halfpenny Bridge hadn't yet been built, where, you know, where Lord Edward's family home in what is now basically the Dáil, an enormous, you can imagine one family living in that.
Incredible.
In that place. But it basically was this mansion built on a, you know, a set of abandoned fields, you know, and Dublin gradually spread from there and filled out the south side of the whole city. So to imagine it, you know, or to see it from the eyes of this Zelig-like figure, to me was great, you know. And also to research the theatre.
Yes.
I mean, there were several, the theatre in Dublin, we all know Handel, Presenter as Messiah in Smock Alley. That was probably several decades before this period. The main theatre was the Theatre Royal in Crow Street, but there were about seven other theatres in Dublin at the time, and all of them are incredibly well documented. You know, what mm-hmm. plays were put on, what actors, the actors would come from London, the famous actors would come from London and, you know, do their kind of renditions of plays that had appeared in Drury Lane, in the Crow Street Theatre, in Smock Alley, and, you know, various other theatres in Dublin. And there was so much richness to be discovered for me, you know, as a writer, really. And to, you know, to place Tony and Lord Edward in that context was kind of brilliant.
Yeah. And guys like me, whenever you write a book, always say to you, oh, you're going to turn it into a film, Neil. But, right, it's me apologizing for asking the same question. But this is very dramatic, you know. And like I said at the start, it rips around. Like, it does feel very cinematic. So, you know, I have to ask, like a TV show maybe, but it seems to me that there's a script here as well as a novel.
Well, I mean, there, I don't think there'll be a movie here because it's too big.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I mean, can you imagine a film that goes from South Carolina to the Caribbean to Ireland?
Imagine the production headaches.
No. You wouldn't get the money for it anyway. But, but I mean, there could well be one of these high-end Netflix series, you know, or Amazon series, you know, that lasts for 12, 13 or 14 episodes, you know.
Yeah.
That would be a possibility. And actually, you know, I'm kind of beginning to talk to various people about that possibility at the moment, but I would say it's a long way off.
Yeah. Well, let's wait and see. I spoke to Jim Sheridan, and that's not to name drop, last year. And I was just saying to him about My Left Foot, how, like, when I was a kid, it was combined almost with, you know, Italia 90, U2 releasing the Joshua Tree, that the idea of films coming out of Ireland was huge, that people could do it here. And not too long after that, I became aware of your movies, and particularly The Crying Game. And Jim kind of intimated at that stage, you know, it was almost a miracle to get movies made in a way. Did you have that sense in your early career that, are we ever going to be able to actually make films? Or did you just have blind youthful confidence?
Well, myself and Jim, we were part of the same theater group, you know, before we started making movies. You know, I mean, I was writing, he was directing, and we were putting on these various extravaganzas in Dublin. But we were always dreaming of making movies. It just seemed impossible, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I made my first movie, Angel, in 1982.
Yeah.
It kind of, you know, played in Cannes. It became a success of a certain kind. And then Jim made My Left Foot, which became this extraordinary success, you know, which was amazing. And, you know, it was, I love Jim's movies, you know. I think he's unique as a director. But we kind of followed each other's rhythm through the years, really. It was very difficult to make films then, believe me.
I can imagine. You know?
I mean, there's a film board now. There's, you know, the costs have dropped precipitously. You can almost make a movie with your iPhone if you've got a bit of imagination and a bit of flair, you know. But then it was difficult. But the great advantage was that we were new. Do you understand what I mean? There was a new sensibility, a new kind of voice, you know. When I went to Hollywood for the first time, there was this tremendous interest in the fact that films could come out of Ireland. You know, when I went to London, I worked with Channel 4 and with the Palace Pictures and people like that. There was a huge amount of excitement about the newness, you know, of one's voice, you know, which was great, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a great period for me anyway.
One thing I'd actually forgotten when I was just reminding myself of all you've done was you directed We're No Angels with Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Now, I know that wasn't wildly successful, but it's a sweet movie. And I remember at the time going, oh, Robert De Niro is trying to do comedies. Was it strange for you, though, to be suddenly, you weren't the writer and you were in some kind of Hollywood machine, and I presume it was Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania filmed it in, with Robert De Niro doing a comedy? It must have been an odd kind of experience.
Well, it was a strange experience. Robert had seen a movie I made called Mona Lisa, and he sent me this script that was written by David Mamet. you know? And I went, oh, this is, you've got to take notice of those names, don't you?
Yes.
And then he flew me to New York to meet up with himself and Sean Penn. And, you know, I was going, why? Well, okay, maybe I'm not sure. And in the end, I was persuaded, you know, and we made this, it was a very expensive movie at the time, actually. We shot it in Canada, and we shot it in Vancouver, you know, and we built these enormous sets, and we had a lot of fun. There was a lot of argument, because when Sean and Robert are involved, there's always a lot of discussions, you know, so it was, I mean, I did love the movie, and people didn't accept Bobby in a comedy, let's put it that way.
Yeah. You know?
Which became the thing he seemed to want to do in later life when he was doing, you know, when he was doing Meet the Fockers and all that sort of stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it has a charm about it.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Your biggest movie in scale is definitely Michael Collins. I've a personal relationship with that in two ways. One, I'm sure everyone says this, I was an extra in the Crow Park scene that was filmed in Bray Wanderers. Mm-hmm. I'll always remember it. And in my later misspent youth, I taught English to Spanish and Italian kids. And I showed them that movie all the time. I must have shown it about 48 times in 1 year. So I know the script and I never tired of it. But I remember at the time, you know, various criticisms about it, historical accuracy, all that kind of thing. And it seems to me now that, you know, through maybe like people like Richard Carney or Dermot Ferreter, who've kind of given us different views of history, that, you know, history's, you know, competing narratives to a certain extent and all that. It seems that movie has a much greater reception now. It's rightly seen as a classic in a way it wasn't 25 years ago. Is that your sense of it, that its appreciation has grown considerably?
Well, perhaps, yeah. I mean, at the time, it was kind of like constructing a national monument, you know, and everybody has ideas about what a national monument should look like.
Yeah.
You know, generally, national monuments are military figures on horses. You know, if the left leg is raised, it means one thing. If the sword is pulled out of the scabbard, out of the belt, it means another. I mean, Michael Collins was made at the time when the peace process was just, when the IRA were attempting to disarm. So there was a huge amount of argument about what Irish history meant and what particularly the 1916 rebellion and the War of Independence meant, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, people took very, very, very kind of intense reactions to those events and to any portrayal of them. So it was fine. I mean, it was like making a film in the middle of a national kind of row, really. But I did enjoy it. I enjoy these situations of kind of absurd conflict. And I loved making the movie, I have to say, you know.
Yeah.
I really did. And it was a unique situation because I just made Interview with the Vampire for Warner Brothers, which made quite a lot of money for them. And they asked me what I wanted to do next. And I mentioned Michael Collins. And, you know, they gave me a sufficient budget to make it in the scale that we all remember, you know.
Yeah. I was just wondering about Stephen Ray and you know, the partnership. I'm wondering what it is he gives you. I've heard him talk about what you give him, but I'm wondering, is it just a sense of, you know, he's on set and you feel good knowing he's there, or is that to do him a disservice?
No, it's to do with intelligence, you know, it's to do with the intelligence. I mean, I've never come across a better reader of a text than Stephen, you know, I have to say. And, often actors, they can be very selfish in their approach to material. You know, they often underline their own parts, you know, with a yellow pen and don't read the rest of them. But Stephen is a writer's kind of collaborator. I mean, he's worked with Sam Shepard. He's worked with Samuel Beckett. He's worked with Brian Friel. He is a great interpreter of complex material. And I think that's why, you know, Beckett wanted to work with them, and Sam Shepard and Brian Friel, and that's why I've wanted to work with them for so long.
And then finally, to take it more up to date, The Borges, a very successful TV show that you created. I'm wondering, you know, I ask this question a lot, but, you know, I'm a proponent of cinema, and I'm longing for the day when this madness ends and we can get back to it and I can take the kids again and all that. But I'm wondering, do you think there's irreparable damage done now because of this pandemic? Do you have any fear that, like, people have sat at home and watched new movies and 20-part Netflix shows that it might be hard to get people back into the cinema. Are you worried about where it goes from here?
Well, not really. I mean, the great thing about cinema and the experience of cinema is you can't put it on pause, you know, and you can't turn it off and go to the bathroom and come back and turn it on again or make popcorn or make a cup of coffee or whatever. You know, you have to endure the two-hour experience, you know, and I think that's a unique kind of thing. And I think, you know, the visual medium suits the idea of the movie far, far better than it does the Netflix series, you know. Mm. I mean, I'm not giving out about Netflix because they're making a ton of movies, actually. Not all of them good. But, you know, to create a visual image, to create a kind of a visual environment, you know, that is expressed through 2 hours of viewing is a different thing than returning to sets every episode and returning to different actors every episode. And do you understand what I mean? I mean, having made the Borgias, I really enjoyed telling a story of that length, basically because you're given the opportunity to make a 40-hour film, basically.
Yeah.
But there is a sense of constant return to the same ideas, you know, or the same environments, the same sets. Basically, in that case, it was what we'd built of St. Peter's in Rome, you know?
Yeah.
And I just say it's not as immediate and it's not as kind of immediately satisfying and transformative as movies are, you know?
Yeah,
I think they'll survive. Yeah, I think they will.
Good. Well, then I cheated. One last question. People will be very curious to know, when you finish talking about the Battle of Lord Edward and Citizen Small and the promo for that and all, what's next for you?
I'm going to make a movie, I think, you know? I'm hoping to. Yeah, but it's a matter of finding the finance, yeah. So
okay.
I hope to be making a movie in September or October.
And is it Irish international or?
It won't be set in Ireland at all.
Okay.
Somewhere in Europe.
I hope the book does very well for you. I will be telling people to read it because, as I say, it's a real page turner. The Ballad of Lord Edward and Citizen Small, published by Lilliput Press by Neil Jordan. Neil, thank you so much for chatting to me today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to this week's new releases, and for which this week we are looking at three, and I'm looking at them in the capable company of Mark Royle. Hello, Mark.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Very well. So this week we're looking at Judas and the Black Messiah, Yes Day, and The Columnist. So why don't we start with Judas and the Black Messiah, which is available from Thursday of this week, the 11th of February, an unusual day for a digital download release. But anyway, such is the strange modern contemporary world we're living in with COVID and all that. What did you think of Judas and the Black Messiah? And maybe tell our listeners a little bit about what's going on in this.
It's available now, yeah. Judas and the Black Messiah, I suppose the Black Messiah is Fred Hampton, who was the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers. And he was assassinated by the FBI in 1969. Then the Judas of the title.
And that, as we should say, sorry to interrupt you, is not a spoiler because as soon as you put his name into Google or wherever, it comes straight up.
That's the thing. Is it possible to spoil history?
Some would say it is, yes. But anyway.
Yeah, well, anyway, he was assassinated by the FBI in 1969. Sorry if I've ruined anything for you. The Judas of the title is William O'Neill, who was a petty criminal, and he was coerced by the FBI into becoming an informant who infiltrates the Black Panthers, and he becomes one of Hampton's closest confidants. And I suppose let's start with the positive. It does convey in no uncertain terms what an incredibly charismatic and intelligent character Hampton was. And Daniel Kaluuya, who plays Hampton, he's immense. And every single second he's on screen, he just draws you in, and he's utterly electrifying. And Hampton is an incredibly powerful public speaker, and some of the speeches that Kaluuya gets to deliver here, it's hair standing up on the back of your neck stuff. It really is.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And Kaluuya, people will know from things like Black Panther and Skins a good few years ago now. He's brilliant.
Yeah, Get Out as well.
Yes, of course. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But he's also portrayed as being very sympathetic and charismatic. And, you know, he not only gets the black gangs on the side of the Panthers, but he also gets the Puerto Ricans and the rednecks on side as well. And of course, this all makes him a very dangerous threat to the FBI. which is all great, except Hampton isn't the central character. Technically, the Judas character, or William O'Neill, is the lead protagonist in this. And I think that's the big problem with Shaka King's movie. The Keith Stanfield plays O'Neill, and the characterization is so confused and morally ambiguous that at a certain point it becomes quite problematic, because first of all, O'Neill agrees to become an informant to avoid jail. Then he does it for a car, and then it's money. But at the same time, Stanfield is playing him as though O'Neill is 100% passionately committed to Hampton and the Panthers. And the script really wants to have it both ways, and you can't have it both ways.
So you found that that got in the way, and I see what you're saying, but you don't think that the O'Neill character, the reason why he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth, is because he was, that when he was deep undercover, he found himself really charmed and inspired by Hampton's character. Is that not the point?
Yeah, but he was also out for personal gain. And I know that the real person was kind of, he was a very ambiguous individual. Yeah. And you know, there's lots of stuff out there if you're curious about what happened. But I just found, like, in the terms of watching a movie, it's just very frustrating. As I said, like, Shaka King, he's not coming down on any particular one side, and there is a villain in this piece, and it is, you know, O'Neill. But it just, the movie, I don't think, really conveys that.
I suppose from a storytelling point of view, he was problematic. Here's something I never thought I'd say. I didn't enjoy Martin Sheen in it. Ah. Martin Sheen plays J. Edgar Hoover.
What were we talking about a couple of weeks ago when I was talking about fake noses? But poor old Martin Sheen. He's the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover. And he is sporting a prosthetic nose that is so ridiculous. I couldn't stop thinking about that Pink Panther movie when Peter Sellers' nose starts melting. And I just don't know why you would go to the trouble of getting Martin Sheen on board and then mush a load of plasticine onto his face.
It was kind of an impersonation of Hoover. It was odd, the portrayal, I just thought.
It was very distracting. Just on the off chance that any actors might be listening to this, can I just say, please, for the love of God, be careful with those prosthetics.
Yeah. Sage advice. So overall, so you're saying the fact, I suppose it's two movies, the Messiah bit, the Hampton character is brilliant, played brilliantly by Kahlua, but you just found the Judas character too, as we said, morally ambiguous. So am I sensing overall the movie didn't work for you?
It did. I'm going to give it a 3.5, I think. And it's mostly for Kahlua, because he's just immense. But as I said, the story is unsatisfying.
Yeah. And I would just counter that it's unsatisfying, but it's kind of what happened in real life, you know, but I guess that's not necessarily what you're looking for when you're sitting down to watch a fictionalized movie. But oddly enough, I was actually going to give it 3.5 as well.
There you go.
I think Kahlua's performance carries the whole thing. So we're in agreement on that. Let's take a quick clip of Judas and the Black Messiah.
You're looking at 18 months for the stolen car, 5 years for impersonating a federal officer, or you can go home.
The Black Panthers are forming a rainbow coalition of oppressed brothers and sisters of every color.
Their aim is to sow hatred and inspire terror.
I will learn all that I can.
These ain't no terrorists.
You can murder and liberate them, you can't murder liberation. You can murder revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom.
A clip there of Judas and the Black Messiah, now available on various video on demand platforms from the 11th of February. That was Thursday of this week. Okay, Mark, yesterday, a new movie on Netflix from this Friday. That's the 12th of February. All these dates this week, it's confusing. I'm staring at a bare wall here. I should have a calendar, but I think I'm up to the task, you know, of being able to give out three different dates.
How are we supposed to keep track of all this stuff?
I tell you. So Yesterday, which is on Netflix from Friday, as I say, with Jennifer Garner and Edgar Ramirez saying yes to their kids for a day, basically.
Yeah. This is definitely not in my wheelhouse at all. Garner and Ramirez are a couple who used to say yes to everything, you know, to skydiving and bungee jumping and journeys of self-discovery around India.
Yeah.
And then kids came along and I suppose yes turned into no. And they decide to give their kids a yes day where they agree to everything their kids want to do for 24 hours. And I found it quite bizarre that they had to specifically state that the kids weren't allowed to kill anybody. that would have been.
You can never tell with kids, you know, you got to spell these things out. And you know, yes days are a real kind of cultural thing. Like people do them.
I'll take your word for that.
Yeah, apparently so. I haven't engaged in it yet. Oh, see what I did there? But yeah. And Jennifer Garner, you know, she's pretty good in it as the mom who's trying to be cool one last time.
Yeah. I got a strong whiff of child actor with pushy mother from whoever was playing the son. I found that particularly objectionable. Like, there was far too much confidence and enthusiasm going on there for my liking. what I will say about this is that it's fine, but I think any family comedy worth its salt will throw a bone to the parents that are stuck in the cinema along with the kids. And it doesn't just aim at the kids. I mean, the good news is that you're not stuck in the cinema now. So, you know, feel free to wander around drinking Kahlua in your pajamas at 11 a.m. and let the kids at it. But yeah, I think the kids might be saying yes to this, but I have a funny feeling parents might be saying no.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, it was fine is what I said. I mean, I didn't hate it or anything. I watched it with my wife without the kids, and I would have really enjoyed watching it with my eldest.
May I ask why?
Well, because I kind of thought it was going to be more about a study in exhausted parenting, if you know what I mean, and saying yes to everything. Because I think the idea, the conceit of it is quite interesting and appealing. Because you do find yourself as a parent saying no, like round the clock. You should just hold up cards. So the idea was good. The execution was fine as well, but it's just a bit, fine.
It's fine, yeah.
Yeah. So what would you say stars-wise?
I think I'm going to give it a generous 2.
Okay, I'm going to give it a 2.5. I did like Jennifer Garner and Edgar Ramirez in it, but nothing to write home about. Won't change your life, but won't upset you too much. That's Yes Day, now streaming on Netflix. Then finally, an interesting movie from Holland called The Columnist, which again, we've both seen. I've seen all three movies this week, which is rare for me, but there you go. I was clearly having a Yes Day to the cinema or something. Anyway, that didn't work at all.
No.
But what's going on in The Columnist?
The Columnist, it's a Dutch satire with the brilliant Katja Herbers. She has shown up in everything from Westworld to The Americans and The Leftovers. So you will definitely recognize her even if you can't place her.
Yeah.
Herbers plays Famke Boot, who is a journalist writing opinion pieces on the ills of society. And she comes in for a lot of vicious online abuse, both in the comments section and on social media. She is also supposed to be writing a book, but she can't put a single word down on paper because she has become obsessed with reading every malicious slur that's fired off anonymously in her direction. Then she discovers that her neighbor is one of the trolls that's been abusing her, and she decides to deal with him. And then as she tracks more of her abusers down, she discovers that her writer's block has disappeared.
What I really liked about this, I don't know if you feel the same, but you know, you and I, you even more than me, watch a lot of movies. A lot of them are from the same wheelhouse. To see a Dutch movie, which just has a slightly different feel about it, this felt very, a bit like, not in the same exact ballpark, but something slightly like, I don't know, The Killing or The Bridge in terms of its Scandi aesthetic. It was just pleasantly different.
I thought it was very similar to Alice Lowe's Prevenge. I don't know if you've seen that.
I'm afraid not.
Ben Wheatley's Sightseers. I know you've seen that one, which coincidentally Alice Lowe wrote. So it reminded me a lot of that. And there's even a hint of John Waters' Serial Mom. Yeah, murder seems to have a very cathartic effect on Famke. And anyone who's ever had an online run-in will get a kick out of this. Now, obviously, revenge fantasies aren't healthy, but they can be fun. And the other thing about this as a revenge fantasy is that some of it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And a lot of the choices that Famke makes seem very illogical. And yes, it does address our unhealthy addiction to online culture and I suppose the insidiousness of anonymous hate speech, but it doesn't try to provide an answer to any of these issues. So I suppose just as long as you don't read into it too much, you should enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's trying to say something, I guess, about hate speech and online drones and all that, but it's not really offering any kind of solution at all. And as you say, it is just a revenge fantasy, but it's bizarre and off the wall, but pleasingly so, very funny. And her daughter and her new love interest when all this happens are both brilliant. I don't really know who the actors are. I presume they're both Dutch, but I thought they were great. And particularly her boyfriend, who's a kind of horror novelist who turns out to be a sweetheart, is kind of great.
It is, yeah. No, it's a really good. It's a black comedy. I think it's been doing rounds at a few of the horror festivals like Fantasia and Fright Fest. But I mean, apart from the high body count, I don't think you could call this a horror. And I certainly wouldn't be put off watching it if you're not a horror fan.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a horror at all. It's a bit gory. There was a tiny bit at the start where she's looking, she hears a noise, and I thought it was going in a horror direction, but then it didn't at all. So I completely agree with you. No, this is a really interesting, fun, dark watch. What would you say stars wise?
I'm going to give it a 4. I loved it.
Wow, 4. Okay, am I going to give it a 4 or 3.5?
Don't change your mind now.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually hadn't decided.
Stick to your gun.
I'll give it a four. I hadn't seen anything like it in a long time, and I certainly enjoyed it. And the old test, I was going to watch the second half of it this morning, but I had to watch to the end. So that's always a good sign. And my wife, who really didn't want to watch it when I told her what it was about, did the same as well, you know. And she gets to go to bed with me. So the idea of her staying up to watch it, you know, she really enjoyed it. So yes.
This is taking a dark turn.
You think the movie's dark? Welcome to my marital bed. No, so I'm going to give it a 4 as well for The Columnist, which is available on all sorts of digital platforms from this Friday. Mark, thank you for sharing.
Thank you, John.
Up next, Fiacna O'Brien on of the Hothouse Flowers on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted to be joined now by the guitarist and, of course, singer with the Hothouse Flowers. Well, I should say vocalist as well, or Lee might get upset. Fiacna O'Brien on, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, John. Nice to chat to you.
You too. Now listen, you know, often musicians don't, I don't think ever a musician has chosen a musical film in the 2 years I've been doing this slot.
Really?
But you have, and it's possibly one of the greatest music films ever made. Will you tell our listeners what you've opted for?
The Last Waltz. The Last Waltz, which is Martin Scorsese's wonderful feature-length concert film of the band's final performance in San Francisco. It was Thanksgiving 1978. It was the Winterland Ballroom. And they initially had planned for it just to be themselves. And then I think Ronnie Hawkins came on board, with whom they'd toured a lot. And their old friend Bob Dylan came on board as well. Yeah. And before they knew it, there was an incredible cast of musicians who joined them on that evening. And it's a thrilling, it's got all my favorites in it. You know, they were joined by Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Dr. John. And of course, Van Morrison was there as well, you know, in his splendor, in his onesie.
Yeah, doing kicks, like karate kicks or something.
Yeah, exactly. I think he had a certain determination, I think, to kind of blow everybody else off the stage, you know. But and I guess some people might think he did, but it was just amazing. And then, of course, there's all those beautiful sequences that they shot on the MGM soundstage afterwards with Emmylou Harris. They did a version of Evangeline, and of course one of my favorites, which is their version of The Wait with the Staples singers, with Pop Staples and his daughter Mavis.
You know, concert movies, you know, I've seen concert movies or concerts of, say, someone I love like Bruce Springsteen, and you enjoy them and all, but you know, at the same time you're just watching a concert and you're thinking, oh, I wish I was there. But this is kind of different. It rises above your average concert movie, right?
It somehow seems to capture, I think what's difficult about making concert movies is to make it feel like you're in the audience, you know, to feel like you're there. And I know that people have commented on The Last Waltz after the, there are places where Richard Manuel is singing, but he's not visible. And it's, you know, clearly because the cameraman couldn't get around the gang of people who are on the stage. But you really do get a sense that you're at the gig, you know. There's a great flow to it. You get a sense from, there are enough close-ups as well of all the players, you know, Robbie Robertson, there's tons of them. I mean, that was a source of consternation for Levon Helm, for example, afterwards. He felt like, you know, Robbie was in cahoots with Scorsese about making this movie more about him than about anybody else. And, you know, arguably he may well have done, you know, but it doesn't take away from the fact that the band were incredible. And, you know, Rick Danko, Levon Helm and Richard Manuel were extraordinary singers. And they were better vocalists than Robbie Robertson. I guess wherever they placed, there was a sense of jeopardy from it as well. You know, I mean, Bob Dylan came along and his people were saying to Scorsese and to the rest of them that he was very happy to do the gig, but they weren't allowed to film him because he had his own movie coming out. So they eventually, I think Robbie Robertson had to persuade him, look, we'll hold off releasing The Last Waltz until Ronaldo and Clara has already hit the cinema screens. And Bill Graham, who is the legendary San Francisco promoter who was running the gig, literally threatened Dylan. said, if you don't get out on that stage, I'll kill you, you know. And you didn't mess with Bill Graham, you know.
Yeah. And is Neil Diamond's appearance kind of incongruous to you, some people have suggested, or...?
I love Neil Diamond as well. He kind of comes and goes a bit as well. But it's, what a song though, you know, Dry Your Eyes. What an amazing song. And what a vocalist. I mean, yes, I guess it's in terms of style and genre, it's a little bit set apart from the rest of them. I mean, you get a sense that Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and Bob Dylan and Dr. John, that they all kind of belong to the same club in a way, and Van Morrison as well, of course, and that Neil has come in from somewhere else. But it's just amazing, you know.
Yeah, no, it is a fantastic film and very nicely evoked by you. And thank you for choosing it. Let me ask you about the Mighty Hothouse Flowers. this is going to age you, but, you know, I remember seeing Don't Go in the Eurovision halftime show.
And yeah.
So you've been the soundtrack of, you know, people of my generation's life in a way. We're talking about The Last Waltz and egos of different people and all that kind of stuff. How have you managed to stay together this long, do you think?
You know, I guess because we've managed to stay, you know, to give each other enough space that we can go off and do our own things. And we've remained friends. We've remained more than friends.
Yeah.
We're family, you know?
Yeah.
I know that if ever there's, and it's always been the case, if ever there's an upset or a crisis or something going on, if I call Liam, he's going to be there for me. And he knows that the opposite is true as well. And the same goes for Peter, you know. Mm. We're like brothers. And I guess that's it, you know. And we enjoy playing. Like, we've done precious little of it, obviously, in the past year.
Yeah.
But when we got together before Christmas and we did a live stream from Whelan's in Dublin, I felt very emotional during that, even though there was no audience. The audience was in my imagination.
Yeah,
and there we were playing our music and feeling the power of that music and putting it out there. We kind of make stuff up as we go along a lot as well, and there's a depth to the musical communication that we thrive on between us, you know.
Yeah,
and I love that, and I think we all love that, and people I think feel that as well. I think they feel it. The brotherhood, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, and people are certainly missing that from you and lots of other people at the moment. I wonder, you have a very loyal fan base, you know, and this is maybe left of center, but is Songs from the Rain everyone's favorite album, do you think?
Songs from the Rain is a huge favorite of the people. There's no doubt about it. It's probably, you know, it may be the most successful of the albums in a way, although a lot of people refer to the debut album as being, you know, it was the biggest selling debut album at the time and so on. But I think Songs from the Rain is certainly viewed in America particularly, I think.
Yeah.
It was bordering on big success in America when we decided to hang it up for a while. And, you know, and people could say we shot ourselves in the foot, but we just had to do that. We had to kind of, for the sake of, you know, our durability and our sanity and our relationships, we had to hang it up for a while and allow everybody the time and space to, you know, put the boat into dry dock for four seasons, you know, which is what we did. And then we came back and we made it, you know, I mean, I'm hugely fond of Into Your Heart, that album, which released in 2004. And then there's been huge fondness for the most recent album, Let's Do This Thing, which got a great review here. I mean, Pat Carty, bless him, of Hot Press, who, you know, keeps talking to me about that record, saying how much he loves it, you know. And a lot of the, you know, and for me, it felt like we were chancing our arm a bit. We were making it up as we were going along in the studio. But then again, there's something in that. There's something in that that is part of the essence of the band. And it's a brave record to make. And it's the type of record we never made before. And I think maybe that's why people love it. You know, it's,
yeah.
But yeah, it's when you think of, to think that The Last Waltz was less than 10 years before Hot House Flowers started. It's only 7 years before The Flowers started.
Wow.
That's a mad statistic.
That is.
To contemplate.
Let's leave that one there. And finally then, Fiacna, you have a late blooming radio career. That makes you sound very old. I don't mean it like that, but you got into radio. You present on Radio 1 now. People really enjoy your music twice. It's hands across the divide here from one national radio station to another. But you seem to be enjoying that immensely.
I really enjoy it. I really enjoy it. I've enjoyed it since the very first nerve-wracking night of making sure that I got to the weather forecast on time and got out in time for the pips at midnight and all that sort of furniture that you have to jump over, you know. But I really love it. And my goodness, this past year, am I blessed to have the radio gig, because not only is it a bit of a living, it's also a weekly immersion into music, into other people's music. And it keeps me in touch with all of that. And so that's been amazing. And I've like, it's been a very interesting year for me. I put out a solo record as well this year, which was a delight. I released a solo record called Bougainvillea. And then I also followed up in last October with my EP, Winter Sun, which your Tom Dunn very kindly played many times on his program. So that was, it's been a remarkable time, but yeah. Getting on, you know, getting to go into RTE and present Late Date, or indeed sit in for John Creedon when I'm asked to do that, is, I love it. I love it.
Good, good. Well, listen, the 7 o'clock news is coming, and as you know, I have to get to that.
You've got to negotiate your furniture.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I hope the flowers continue to bloom for a long time to come. His favorite movie is The Last Waltz. Fiacna O'Brien on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fiacna O'Brien on there of the Hot House Flowers talking to me about, well, his musical life and times, I guess, and his life and times in general, but also his favourite movie, which is The Last Waltz, the great concert film, maybe the greatest concert film ever made. Bold statement, I know, directed by Martin Scorsese with the band and a whole host of other people. Didn't play a clip because it's mostly music, but I will play out with some music from The Last Waltz in a moment. But before I do, I will just remind you that this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I want to thank Anne-Marie Kane as she helped out on the show this week, as she does every week. And my thanks to her. Lots on the show next week. Just haven't decided what I'm putting out because there's a lot going on, but more of that next week. Enjoy St. Patrick's Day. Whatever you're doing, do it safely. Try and do it at home. Stay safe. We're getting through this. Let's hold firm for another wee while, and maybe we'll all have some blue water soon. As I say, I'm going to leave you with some music from The Last Waltz. This is the great song, The Wait. This version from The Last Waltz obviously features the band and Levon Helm on vocals, but also has the staple singers. So enjoy this and have a great weekend.
I pulled in to Nazareth, feeling about half past dead. Just need to find a place where I can lay my head. Mr.
place to hide. When I saw old Carmen and the devil walking side by side, I said, hey, Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around. That